So for me, my heart has always belonged to natural history museums because it kind of seeks to answer these questions of like, who we are, why are we here, how do things work, like all of that just big picture stuff that is hard to fathom.
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential. Mackenzie Finkley is an anthropologist and the author of Beyond the Halls, an insider's guide to loving museums. While attending the University of Texas, she discovered her love of the humanities, human culture, and archaeology. She also developed an interest in museums and their cultural history. Mackenzie published Beyond the Halls to make museums more accessible, user-friendly, and fun for visitors seeking to enrich their experience. Okay. I'm here with Mackenzie Finkley, anthropologist and museum enthusiast. And you're the author of Beyond the Halls, an insider's guide to loving museums. I'm so glad to have you here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about writing.
Yes, we are.
That good stuff. Okay. But first, tell us about your anthropology. Like, how did that, where did that pathway emerge from? How did you get on that path to anthropology?
Happy to. I love this question because, you know, truthfully, I kind of stumbled upon it. It wasn't really a discipline that was at the forefront of what I understood people could study going into undergrad. When I started my undergrad, I just kind of chose civil engineering because it was something that my dad was doing. And he was like, you're good at math and science. Like you could hack this. And I was like, all right, let's give it a whirl. And what really interested me about civil engineering was the way that humans were interacting with the built environment. And when I quickly realized that really the physics and the calculus was not getting me out of bed in the morning, I made a pivot, kind of removed those two pieces. And what I was left with was anthropology and architecture, which is what I ended up kind of studying in undergrad. Not kind of, actually getting my degree in. So I majored in anthropology, minored in architecture, and then I got a certificate in museum studies. So did a lot of things a little bit all over the place. But the coolest part about each of these disciplines was when I would take classes, each of the other disciplines would appear in lecture about each of the other disciplines. Hopefully that makes sense. So they were all kind of intertwined together in a way. But when I was kind of looking and just deciding what I wanted to study, it literally was combing through the course catalog until I decided like, the study of humanity, how fascinating does that sound? And just kind of went for it.
Excuse me. I like that. That story kind of reminds me of, well, yours seemed a little bit more structured, your search for a major, but my cousin, when he started undergrad school at UCLA, he didn't know what he wanted to study. So he took the catalog book and he just threw it. It fell open. And then he threw like a pen or pencil on a page and wherever it landed, that's what he studied. And it landed on math. So he ended up getting a degree in math, but and that worked out for him. But that, I love that. That's wonderful. So tell us about your love of museums. And what is it about museums that really draws you in?
Yes. So I love museums. I was definitely someone who was taken to museums as a kid, really enjoyed going on field trips to museums, not just to get out of the classroom, but to actually have that like really hands-on learning experience. I thrived in that environment. And so when I was studying anthropology, and a lot of anthropology classes, especially the cultural ones, we would talk about museums and these, you know, cultural heritage on display was kind of ultimately what I started to specialize in. So I did a lot of writing on this. I did a lot of research on this. And so I thought, you know, why not compile all of this into a book? Like I thought, you know, I'd love to write a book. That seems like a really cool goal to have. And the thing was, is I wanted it to actually be a book that my friends would want to read, right? And the thing was, is in all of my studies, I was coming across all of these textbooks that I was having to read. And when I would go to museums, I would visit the gift shop and I would have, you know, all of these guides to specific museums or specific cities. But I was hard pressed to find something that was kind of in between. So I wrote it.
So when you say you wanted to write a book that your friends would want to read, you wanted to make it more accessible. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted it not only to, well, so museums are made for everyone. They should be for everyone. So I wanted the book to emulate that same idea.
And this idea of cultural heritage on display, is it the, because I'm an English teacher and in the 10th grade curriculum, it's all about cultural heritage. It's stories from international short stories from around the world. And then we get into your family history and your family culture and bringing in artifacts from your family to share with the class. So what is it about cultural heritage that you think really interests you? Is it obviously it's a lot of history behind or involved in cultural heritage, but what is it about that?
What interests me most about cultural heritage, especially cultural heritage on display, is how every day there is something new for me to learn about a different person, whether it's a person in my same culture or a person in a totally different culture. There just seems to be kind of an endless amount of learning opportunities and people on the planet and things and stories. Stories are the best.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that warms my heart, the idea of like bringing in an artifact or family heirloom and talking about why it's important to you. Mm-hmm. I did that in one of my graduate courses, and that was a really fun day to get to hear about all these different reasons why each of these particular things was so special or culturally significant to someone.
Right. And what is it about humanity that fascinates you the most?
It's kind of those big picture questions, you know, like, so for me, my heart has always belonged to natural history museums because it kind of seeks to answer these questions of like, who we are, why are we here? How do things work? Like all of that just big picture stuff that is hard to fathom. And I think that's what's most fascinating about learning about the history of humanity and where we came from and how we just started working together and the things that we've created. It's incomparable to anything else.
Did you learn anything about yourself that you hadn't really quite understood or even maybe even recognized prior to starting to study the history of humanity or anthropology?
I've learned so many things about myself, not only just like biologically where I came from and all of the many, many ancestors that came before me, going back hundreds of thousands of years, but also why I do the things that I do and why other people act the way that they do. I think that part is really interesting. The ways in which we work together and how I personally collaborate best with others and why that is. And I know that this is a very generic answer, but there's just like so many, too many things to list.
Almost. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I would think that a lot of us would probably benefit from studying the history of humanity because it sounds like you learned a lot about the similarities within all of us, the things that connect us just as humans. And I think a lot of the issues that we face, not only in this country, but worldwide, obviously, are because we don't really understand each other's culture. We don't understand the differences. We're scared of the differences, and we're scared of different cultures.
And you gain such a great respect for human life.
I totally get that. All right, so then let's talk about how you started to write this book. Because you had this idea to make the museum experience more accessible for people. What was the first step? Did you just sit down and start typing, or was there some prep work?
Yeah. So in my introduction, I kind of touch on the thought that in many ways I've been preparing my entire life for writing this book. In that, and I know that sounds so corny, but in that, a lot of what this book contains is personal anecdotes from museum adventures that I've had throughout my life, primarily as a young adult.
Yeah.
But so in terms of when it came down to sitting and writing about it, the first thing I did was collect all of the things that I had already written for classes and rework them so that they were actually kind of fun to read and add some anecdotes and context for people that aren't my professor, you know, reading the essay. And then the next thing was kind of like one of the most helpful pieces in putting this book together was I set out and I connected with and interviewed people who are museum professionals in the industry. And I had conversations with them, asked them how they came, their journey to their job, what's a day in the life like for you, what's your favorite museum, and just the stories that I would get out of people would inspire different pieces. Someone might say one thing that inspires a whole chapter, or someone's entire story might inspire a chapter. So it was a number of things, or like museums in the news. I get on my soapbox when it comes to talking about repatriation and reparations for museum artifacts and things like that, in terms of, you know, going back to colonialism and pulling all of these artifacts from their homeland without permission, right, or warrant. So, and then refusing to give them back later. So a lot of different things. It really runs the gamut in terms of the history of museums, history of different types of museums, fun games to play in museums to make them more accessible, how museums are working to be more accessible for people, in terms of reading ability, visual impairment, physical ability, all kinds of things. So yeah, there's a little bit of something in it for everybody.
Mm-hmm. And now the games, how is that? Because if I go to a museum, it's almost like going to a library where you got to be really quiet and very respectful. And so how do you play games in a museum, Mackenzie?
Yes, it's an excellent question, and I love talking about this. So two things. When I first learned about this particular theory in one of my classes, it was called the exhibitionary complex. And the too long didn't read of that is museums were created in such a way, and the rules that were created at the beginning of museums were to create model citizens. So you go into a museum, it's no eating, no running, no talking, no pictures, no fun, no breathing, whatever, right? And then you hope, as the creator, that these people will continue to do those things on the streets, you know, outside of the museum. They continue to act proper and polite and quiet, which I thought that was so interesting, because now modern museums are kind of turning that on its head, in that you have a lot of what used to be were these just rows and rows of things and stuff.
Right.
Labels is now, especially in natural history museums, these interactive wonderlands of things you can touch and play with. And so now turning this on its head, a lot of museums hire museum educators to do this exact job. So museum educators are typically the people you'll run into if you go on a school field trip. They will come up with things for visitors to do in relation to the artifacts on display to help you learn more about them and contextualize them. So I've come up with kind of a set of, or at least two or three games that I've learned from museum educators in my past that can be applied to multiple museum experiences.
Okay. So these games would be led by these museum educators.
Well, you can do them yourself.
Well, you can do them yourself. Okay. I think when I like the traditional idea of a museum is something like the Getty here in LA, where it's artwork, or even like the Huntington Library type of thing, where it's just, you know, it's books, art, quiet, walk around. But then I think about the like the museum, the Natural Science Museum, Natural History Museum here in LA. Very fun, like very hands-on, all kinds of cool things you can do with your voice. Like I remember going to this one exhibit where they were I don't know how to say it properly, but like measuring the decibel, like how you scream and it gives you like how many decibels you're putting out or whatever it is. I mean, it was so much fun, right? So I think, yeah, that museums can be a lot of fun, and it would be great if that experience that I have at the Natural Science Museum, Natural History Museum, can somehow be brought to the Getty. That's so very proper. That would be very, very interesting. Okay, so you said you've been prepping to write this book for a while. So you had, and I love this idea of taking your old pieces from college that you wrote for your professors and then adding some personal narrative there to make that more accessible for like the average reader. So taking something academic and making it a little bit more accessible. That's actually I think I'm going to steal that idea, Mackenzie. That's like
really. Do it 100%. Because yeah. Honestly, that's another way to just make learning and education more accessible to people.
Yeah.
Maybe have access to higher education. And it's like, why not share those ideas and things that have been learned?
Yeah, that's a really good idea. And so you had all this kind of stuff already. So really it kind of sounds like it was just a matter of kind of organizing it, adding on to it in such a way that you could produce a book.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And so when you do mention that no one writes a book alone, which I think I was actually talking to another author a few days ago, a crime fiction author who co-wrote books with over a dozen books with five other authors. I said, how do you even do that? And he said, it works out really well because he sits down with his fellow author beforehand and they kind of plan out the book as far as plot and characters and all that stuff and what's going to happen. And then he said, one person says, I'm going to take chapters 1 through 3. That person writes chapters 1 through 3, gives it to their fellow author who reads it, adds comments, and then adds to it. And then it just goes back and forth. And it's kind of being edited at the same time. But I just thought, oh my. And I said, isn't it hard to get it to sound like one voice? And he said, no, it actually works out really well. So tell me about your experience with when you say no one writes a book alone. I don't know if you mean that literally or what do you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So I cannot speak to like actually co-writing a book. That's not what I do. But what I can speak to is anyone who wants to write a book. A lot of what we envision book writing to be is just the writer, you know, Hemingway sitting alone in a cafe, right? Just in a corner in the dark, typing it out or handwriting it out. And the reality is that is going to be possibly the slowest and most difficult way to produce a book, because when I say nobody writes a book alone, this book is written in many ways by all the people I interviewed. It's uh-huh. by all the editors who had their hands in helping me make my voice really sharp. Mm-hmm. It's all of the fellow writers that I spent doing writing time with, where we would sit down together in silence and just write together and hold each other accountable. Yeah. So nobody writes a book alone really means it's, again, just another humanity collaborative effort, right? That really just produces something that looks beautiful. And the same thing goes for like the cover designers, like working with someone who produced that. I worked with at least 5 different people with a different editor title to make this book sound really great. And all the people along the way who coached me about things about author life and, you know, self-publishing, being your own agent, your own PR person, your own marketer. So learning from lots of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think you mentioned writing groups. That's a very good, that's a great idea, especially if you do have an issue with just carving out the time to write consistently. It's great to have a group of people that will hold you accountable and sit there and just write in silence for you. It's actually really, especially if you share afterwards, because sometimes they do that type of thing where you kind of share out, you walk away from there feeling pretty empowered. And really good that you got some writing done.
Yes. And yeah. If you know you can't think of a word, all you have to do is look up and say, hey, what word? And you've got like five dictionaries of brains, yeah, you know, in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. But all those people that you mentioned, like the editors, the designers, if you have, I don't know, beta readers maybe, or like any, the people you interview. So yeah, they are all part of that, of the process. That's a very good point. So then talk a little bit about, as part of your process, where you write, because I know you believe that writing setting is very important to the process. So where do you write?
Writing setting is incredibly important to the process. So for me, my favorite place to write is in a cafe or a library. Mm-hmm. And that has been increasingly hard to do in the last year, and less so as time goes on, thankfully. But my favorite thing to do in the production of this book, so like this book was published in December of 2019, for context, is I would go and I would sit in a cafe, either by myself or with a friend that could watch my stuff when I go to the bathroom. and I would sit.
That's important.
Because you feed off of the energy of all these other people around you being productive and doing things. Mm-hmm. And that really helped me a lot. So then fast forward to attempting to write, you know, during the pandemic and working on a second book, for example, I have a desk in my office and I went and I found another free desk because I now have my desk where I work and my desk where I write. Because I already work so much on my computer, but just by picking up the computer and putting it somewhere else so I get into a different headspace to start being more creative helps me immensely.
Okay, that's, yeah.
I have one in particular who likes to go to the park and handwrite everything. Mm-hmm. She'll go and she'll sit for an hour and handwrite and then come back home and type it up on her laptop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've known people that the setting means a lot as far as their productivity. And so they have like a separate, like a little corner in this particular room where they always write, or sometimes they'll go to a cafe or wherever. And that does help, because I think it's that being able to separate like this part of my life, like this writing part of my life, from the other stuff that will tend to distract from that. If you have like that space set up just for that activity. That's a very good point. Good point. So what do you believe as far as editing while you're writing? Do you like to just kind of pour everything out and then later go back and edit, or do you edit as you go along?
Yes. So there are a lot of different editing strategies that I'll just take depending on the day, the same way that there's a lot of different writing strategies. My personal favorite is the, what I call writing without judgment. Mm-hmm. And then the classic, like the sticker you've probably seen on, you know, mugs or t-shirts, is write without judgment, edit without mercy. Mm-hmm. But I like to call this method kind of writing without judgment because it's something I learned in a class about writing ethnographies. And there was this great book that we had to read for the class called Writing Without Teachers. And in that book, it talked about this method where, and this is what we would do every week for class, our professor would assign the 4-hour essay. Cool. So what you do with the 4-hour essay is the professor gives you a prompt and then you sit down, you set a timer for 45 minutes and you write without stopping. You don't judge yourself. You don't think about whether it sounds any good, whether the word choice is good or the grammar or anything. You just write. And if you want to put a word in there later, you just leave like a blank space, like underscores or something. And you just keep going and don't stop until that timer goes off. And when that timer goes off, then you set the timer for 15 minutes and you go back and edit what you wrote. You can do so without mercy because you were writing without judgment. And then the professor would suggest that you do that again 3 more times. Mm-hmm. To produce a full work. And this is a method I like to suggest to authors because it really helps getting over that writer's block. You know, just sitting down and doing something. Mm-hmm. Even if, you know, you're sitting down for 45 minutes and all you get out is two sentences, like you still got out something. And if that starts to get you over that hump, then that's what it is you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that free writing is what we called it in grad school. When you just sit down and write, I wouldn't do it for four, that's a long time, 45 minutes. But with my students, we would do it for 5 minutes, just high schoolers. You just sit down and put the timer on for 5 minutes and you write whatever comes to your head. You don't judge it. You just let it flow. And then you go back and you read it and you see if there's maybe a little something that you could start with, right, as far as your paper, because there might be. I call it mentally vomiting on the paper, and then you go back and you clean it up. Later. But that, yeah, you're right. It gives you just the freedom to get something out, right? Because I think a lot of writers, particularly younger writers and adults too, I guess, we procrastinate, we don't write because we want a perfect first draft, right? And that is not going to happen, but that's what keeps us kind of frozen or paralyzed. And if you kind of give yourself the freedom to be messy, and then go back and clean it up. It's very liberating. Yeah. Very good, Mackenzie. You have some great tips here. Okay, now you also talk about what different types of writers.
Yeah.
Yeah, talk about that.
Okay, so something I learned about myself in the writing process, and something I also learned from collaborating with other writers, is that there are many different types of writers. And generally, this type is kind of broken down in terms of the cadence of your writing. Huh. How often do you write? For instance, Stephen King, who says that he sits down and he writes at least 500 words a day, like never any less, like every single day, wakes up and does it. That is a very disciplined writer. Mm-hmm. Versus what I learned about myself is that I am an episodic writer. Mm-hmm. I will sit down and write when I feel like it, and I will crank out just a ton of stuff. So I may sit down and write 2,000 words one day and nothing for 3 days, and then come back and write 3,500 words, you know, or feel completely blocked for 2 weeks and then sit down and crank out 5,000. So it's also just learning that whatever your method is okay. Like, you're producing something, you're doing it on your own timeline, and whatever works for you to ultimately produce that great product at the end and, you know, really be true to yourself. You don't have to feel this pressure to be Stephen King in that way.
Do you have any other strategies for the times when you feel blocked? Right. Like, I know a lot of people will take a walk or listen to music, maybe even watch a film, you know, and anything to kind of get their creative juices going. And, you know, the interesting thing is a lot of ideas come to me in the shower. Isn't that weird?
No.
Sometimes taking a shower is, but you know, I thought it was, you know what, it's not weird. It's actually, I think, pretty normal, because I was talking to a psychologist earlier this year or later last year, and she said that makes perfect sense that you would find so many ideas kind of just raining upon you in the shower, because it's this place of total relaxation. No one bothers you. The water feels nice, and it's just, you're relaxed. And so all of it just kind of comes to you. But so sometimes if I'm feeling like I just, nothing's coming to me, I'll jump in the shower. Do you have any strategies that you use?
Absolutely. So a similar place in regard to the relaxation of a shower is right before I fall asleep. Keep a notebook in your bedside table, because I know I'm not the only one who's like, right as I'm falling asleep, I have this like really great idea. And I'm like, but I'm just going to go to sleep and forget it in the morning. Yeah. So instead, you know, I roll over, quickly write, scribble something that hopefully I can read in the morning. And then I can go to sleep. easily knowing that I can wake up and that great idea will still be there for me to work on.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good idea. And, you know, keeping a voice, well, I guess this is not 1986, but we don't have little voice recorders anymore. But on your cell phone, there's usually a voice recording app. I have one on my phone. And so sometimes if I have an idea and I can't write it right away, I will just record the idea verbally on the recorder app and then listen to it. That's another great idea. Just if you're, if you find that you're pressed for time and I got to get this down
That's
now.
Definitely one I used for the production of this book. So I would go on a museum adventure and then I'd get in my car and I would just have thoughts. And so I'd turn on the recorder and just vomit right into the recorder. And then, you know, cause I'm about to drive, I can't sit down and write yet. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And do you find if you're in like visiting a museum or in the park or wherever, do you find that you're inspired a lot in those particular spaces? I guess my question is, what spaces most inspire you, or places? Or is there maybe people that you hang around that most inspire you, you get ideas from? And
yeah, the things that most inspire me is one, absolutely place. Going to museums and existing in those spaces. I love going to museums alone because I can do whatever I want. I can wander, I can sit and I can stare at one object for as long as I like. And really get inspired by it, take in all of the details and think about the history and all that great stuff. The other thing too that really inspires me is the work of others. So if there's someone that I want to be like, or if there's a theme that I want to explore, so right now I'm trying to write a fiction novel. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is I watch a lot of movies and I read, not a lot, but a good deal of books that are in the genre that I'm trying to explore, or explore the similar themes that I'm trying to explore. And it's really fun because I love watching movies.
Oh, me too. Oh, I love film. I love classic film, particularly like movies from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. I'm thinking of exploring more silent films and really use it. It's not really my thing, but the silent films, that's just another rich history in and of itself, silent film. So yeah, that's great. Films. And now, do you listen to music when you write?
Yes, sometimes. One of the things I really like to listen to is either classical piano or piano covers of songs that I already know.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be like pop songs and it's on the piano. So I'm not tempted necessarily to, like, you don't hear competing words when you're trying to write words.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite things to listen to when I'm writing are the Harry Potter soundtracks. John Williams, anything John Williams composed, or some of the Alfred Hitchcock soundtracks. I can't think of the composer's name, Bernard Herrmann, I think. It kind of puts me in that mood of, yes, adventure. We're going to do this. That's great. So, and in closing, Mackenzie, what advice would you have for the writer who is feeling a little bit frustrated right now, like they've started to write something but they don't feel it's going anywhere, or they don't have any good ideas and they just kind of want to give up?
Yeah, one of the things that I talk with authors a lot, they're like, my writing sucks, I hate it. It's like, okay, I'm not here to invalidate your feelings. What I want you to do is I want you to ask yourself why you don't like it, because if you ask yourself why you don't like it, you're probably going to be able to figure out a way to fix it. So if you don't like the tone, or if you don't like where the story is going, like, you are the author, you can make it go, do, and be however you please. Mm-hmm. If you feel like your vocabulary is not up to snuff, go and get a dictionary. If you feel like it's just stuck and uninteresting, look for a second opinion, have someone else read it. There's an endless number of solutions. And so really the question is like, if you're feeling stuck or you don't like what you're producing, ask yourself why you feel that way. Because the other thing too is, if you're feeling stuck, you know, maybe you're stressed, maybe you're overworked, you know, it could be a number of things. So be kind to yourself.
Yeah, that's, I think that is the key, right? Because if you're coming down really harshly on yourself and feeding a lot of negativity into your mindset, then that's going to definitely affect your output. Yeah. Great. But tell us where we can find you.
You can find me in all corners of the internet. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on my website, mackenziefinkley.com. You can find my book on Amazon and anywhere online where books are sold.
Thank you very much, Mackenzie Finkley. I really enjoyed that discussion and conversation about museums with Mackenzie, because I've always seen them as these very rich cultural spaces. I never really considered how much fun I have or could have at museums just based on how much there is to learn. So I hope that you check out her website and learn a little bit more about her and her love of museums, and check out her book because she makes museums just these really exciting places to visit. And in the meantime, also visit zazo.com and sign up for my newsletter. You can find me at Twitter at Ebony Haywood. You can find me on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Motivation to Write. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will see you next week when I talk to another fabulous guest. Thanks. Bye-bye.